I ask Betty for the privilege of introducing her this morning. Betty is a lifelong Unitarian and resident of this area with a few sojourns in other places. This is the first in Betty's lay ministry on books that have made a difference. And Betty comes to this with the background of being the most voracious reader I have ever met. And she always brings many and interesting things to Upham Woods each year to share with us of all the interest that she has. So I think we're all looking forward to Betty Jolling's lay ministry and her picking out some things for us to hear about in terms of books that have made a difference. Thank you, Betty.
You'll have to bear with me because I didn't have time to type it. It's written and I might miss some of the words. When Bob asked me to put together some ideas on books that have made a difference, I made a two-page list. Then I realized that your list and mine might be different. But I think we can all agree that for Western civilization, the Bible and the Quran must be at the top of our list. For quite a few years, I've collected books about the Bible to sort of combat the Christian fundamentalist belief that every word is the word of God and is the only truth. The first thing I have read is the Book of Jay, which is about one of the writers of the Old Testament. Jay stands for Yahwist, what scholars agree is the oldest strain in the Pentateuch, probably written in the 10th century BCE. Later strands are revisions or censorings of J, and they are E, the Elohus, P for the priestly school that wrote nearly all of Leviticus, D for Deuteronomy, and R for the redactor who finally did the final revision after the return from Babylonian exile. Harold Bloom considers J to have been a female member of the court after Solomon. Jay was not a historian or a theologian, he says. She was more literary, like Kafka. Another book is Exodus, the true story behind the biblical account by Ian Wilson. Another is Out of the Desert, Archaeology and the Exodus Conquest Narratives by William Stevens, who asks, was the Exodus historical? Probably, but on a much smaller scale. For instance, they say there were like 600,000 people marching across the desert for all those years, but probably they were just small tribes of people moving around in the hills. The Israelites are supposed to have were destroyed long before the time of the Sinai. The place, some of the towns that the Israelites were supposed to have come to were destroyed long before the time when they think they were walking, like Jericho. Jericho, according to the English archaeologist, had fallen down before the Jews got there. In the Dead Sea Scrolls section, Ban and Lay detail the 35 years of keeping the scrolls from being translated because the people in charge of the scrolls were all the Catholic archaeologists from the Vatican. And it seems there might be some ideas there that were contradictory to their faith. Perhaps Jesus was an Essene who lived in a small community way out in the desert. Some of the ideas of the Essenes are in these scrolls, and they predict a Messiah 200 years before Jesus. Then there's a wonderful book called Folklore in the Old Testament by Sir James Frazer. He traces some stories of the Bible in the mythologies of dozens of tribes and peoples around the world. For instance, the Maasai in Africa have the same law about not cooking kids in their mother's milk. And Moses told the Israelites. as one of his laws, one of his first laws. Unfortunately for true believers, we have a large number of studies since 325 A.D. at the Council of Nicaea, still by some of the herding tribes in the, around the world.
If you cook the kid
or the calf or whatever in its mother's milk, that the mother will go dry and you won't have any milk anymore. The large number of studies since 325 at the Council of Nicaea, where they decided what to keep and what to put out in the Christian Bible, and these stories show how humans, mainly patriarchal priests, have shaped the Gospels to justify their own beliefs to maintain their power or the power of their kings. There are also studies of ethics and how they evolved and were used to justify and connect the rulers to their past, from the Mwendo epic of Central Africa, the Mahabharata of Hindu India, tales of King Arthur, the Kalevala of Finland, the Iliad of the Greeks, and perhaps the Bible. All use hero tales to build their society's concepts of proper, correct, admirable life, and reinforce that group's customs. In Creation by Gore Vidal, he describes the adventures of Cyrus Batama, who was an ambassador of Xerxes, the Persian king, to the court of Athens. He is revered as a grandson of Zoroaster, an early believer in the one god, Ahura Mazda. He goes to India as an ambassador for the king, where he meets Buddha, and then to China, where he meets Confucius and Tao. And Vidal puts all these philosophers in the period around 400 BC. And the implication is that at this period in human history, people in widely separated areas were confronting questions of mortality and creation from a background of beliefs in multiple gods. Probably some of your Sunday school children have been studying, like, the Indian Native Americans' creation stories, Gilgamesh creation stories. Those are the things that he's talking about. Many years ago, I took a course from Professor Winspear on early Christianity in the Greek and Roman Empire. The young Protestant students in the front row who came to hear the gospel were extremely disappointed to hear of the pre-Christian virgin births and creation flood stories from Babylonia and heroes who died and were reborn in Egypt, that had all been borrowed by the Hebrews from Mesopotamia, Greece, and Egypt. According to studies of Bible history, the first written accounts of Jesus' teachings were in Aramaic and Greek around 200 AD. Then they were translated from Greek into Latin by St. Jerome, I think it was, and then from Latin and Greek they were translated to English, so that in like 1300 there were monks in monasteries writing new little Bibles you could carry around and read, and this was the explosion of learning about the Bible at that period. Anyway, every time you translate you miss something. So the original language is probably not what we're reading in our modern Bible at all. The Apostle Paul, who after his conversion from playboy to follower of Jesus, was the one who organized the small congregations of Christians, writing epistles to tell them what to do and what to believe. He's famous for his saying, "It is better to marry than to burn." He decided that, of course, after he'd been living with all kinds of women for years. Until Emperor Constantine of Constantinople was converted and made Christianity the state church, Christians were oppressed, arrested, torn apart by wild animals in the forum, impaled on sharp posts, crucified or beheaded, and had their property seized. Numerous saints were created by this treatment. Christians hid underground tools to conduct their services. Constantine called together his bishops, and they decided which gospels could be included in the Bible and which unbelievers they should exile to outer Mongolia or somewhere. They didn't like the Gnostics. I had an awful time with that word because it's got a G in the front of my mouth. Who were too individualistic. So they were called heretics, and all their manuscripts were destroyed, except in Egypt in 1983, shepherds discovered large pottery jars containing various Gnostic gospels and stories about Jesus and his family and his relations to Mary Magdalene, a prostitute. These have been translated and are described in a book by Elaine Pagels. It's back there on the table. When the Crusaders organized after the Council of Clermont in 1096 by Pope Urban II, thousands of people at loose ends because of poverty joined up and went to plunder Palestine. On their way through Germany, they massacred thousands of Jewish citizens who were trying to find safety in the cathedrals. They were their friends, the Catholics, who told them they'd be safe, but they weren't. A lot of Crusaders were captured by pirates and sold into slavery. Many of those who got to the Holy Lands were starved and killed in battles with the well-organized Arab Muslim defenders of their lands. The Crusaders were successful in a few of the battles, and the king was set up to rule the walled cities on the coast of Jerusalem. Eleanor of Aquitaine, she's one of my favorite people. You probably saw a movie about her once with Catherine Hepburn. Anyway. Eleanor of Aquitaine and the French King Louis went on a crusade together, and when they left the safety of her uncle's fort, they were defeated, and the remnants of their army had to sail back to Rome. Crusaders continued for several hundred years, and crusades of various kinds, started by the Christian bishops against unbelievers in Poland, Egypt, Spain, or wherever there was somebody that didn't agree with this bishop, then he'd start a crusade against them. So it went on for quite a while. An interesting novel called The Romance of the Rose, that was made into a movie too. It gives examples of the politics of keeping the monks ignorant of the signs of Aristotle hidden in their manuscript collections. In the time of Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand in Spain, thousands of people were tortured, chopped to pieces, stretched on the rack, and burned as heretics, including the entire Jewish population and the Muslims, who were killed unless they embraced Christianity and then spied on for any slip-ups. The church and the crown confiscated the property of heretics, and anyone who was mad at his neighbor could accuse him or her with no evidence and enjoy seeing them burned. The church was right there when Columbus and numbers of greedy sailors and merchants invaded North and South America, spreading contagious disease and killing and torturing the natives who refused to work in the mines, chopping off hands of those who didn't reach their quota for the gold of the day. A few friars collected stories of the Aztecs and Maya, but they were mostly anxious to save the souls of these savages. Missionaries from various faiths invaded Africa with the message of God's love and fought among themselves and with the natives to achieve their goals, changing their way of life to accommodate the colonies and copying the individualistic, uncaring societies existing in Europe while they taught the natives the message of the Bible. It is so ironic, I mean, these Christians. During the Middle Ages in Europe, many scholars reading the Bible for themselves disagreed with the Catholic Church and were declared heretics and burned at the stake after torture. There was even one guy who was like, died or something, and 10 years afterwards he was declared a heretic and they dug him up and burned. And Michael Servetus, who you might remember as one of the founders of belief in one God instead of three, was burned at the stake. And of course, Joan of Arc was burned at the stake because she saved the French king, but she was a heretic or something. You know, angels spoke to her and they didn't believe it. Then there were all these Protestants, Martin Luther, John Calvin, John Knox, Roger Williams, John Milton, John Owen, the Quakers, who developed ideas and were persecuted or exiled along with their followers. The Mormons were persecuted as they traveled west to Utah. And today, Jews, Muslims, pro-choice defenders of clinics, Afro-Americans in the wrong neighborhood, homosexuals, bad ladies, mentally retarded, teenage mothers, all are persecuted by fellow citizens who think they are Christians. Now I'll start on the Quran. Well, what's it, in case you wonder, I'll tell you what you have to do to become a Muslim. There's an interesting book here called Islam, The View from the Edge, and by Richard Bulliott, who's a historian of Islamic history, and he describes the development of the Muslim faith. I just thought I'd tell you at the beginning that if you want to become a Muslim, there are only five things you have to do. You have to say, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. Incidentally, maybe I'm mispronouncing some of these words. If you can pronounce them better, shout it out. Then you have to pray five times a day. And if you were ever in one of the Eastern countries, you'll hear them always calling out for prayers early in the morning. And you have to wash before you pray because you're supposed to be clean when you pray to God. And you have to give alms. That's one of the three, five things. And at the Feast of Ramadan, you have to fast all day during which you don't eat or drink anything, not even water, till sundown. And this is in the ninth month of a 33-year cycle. So this year, Ramadan was a couple of weeks ago. It could be in September another time. And at least once in a lifetime, you have to go on a pilgrimage to the sacred mosque at Mecca. Those are the five things you have to do. In addition, you may not drink wine, eat pork, gamble, or practice usury. And you have to accept the Sharia, or the legal court's decisions, as a system and law of life. Now, this is a very simple thing to do to become a Muslim. And this is one of the reasons why Islam was so successful, because you didn't have to be able to read. See, everything you learned about Muhammad, about his sayings, was oral. During the course of this book that I was reading on Islam View from the Edge, he gives an example of what they call a hadith from an 11th century biography of religious scholars from the Iranian city of Gorgan. The messenger of God, God's prayers and peace be upon him, said to his companion, Abdulrahman bin Samura, O Abdulrahman, do not seek to command, for if you are given, it will be because you asked, you will bear the full responsibility. But if you are given without asking, God will assist you in it. So a successful politician in Muslim faith is not supposed to ask to be elected. So the democratic elections in this country, with all the candidates talking about how they ought to be chosen, is contrary to their beliefs. Today's Islamic activists have inherited from this historical tradition a claim to authority, which holds promise of restructuring the political, cultural, and moral atmosphere of the Middle East. The authority they wield is the ability to answer questions raised by believers in a fashion that convinces the believer of their correctness. A little history. In 611 AD in Mecca, Muhammad heard a voice that he and the 800 million Muslims today consider to be revealing God's word. And he began to recite this growing body of revelations to his community. In 622, unbelieving Meccans forced him and his community to move to the nearby oasis of Medina. They called themselves Muslims, those who make submission to Islam, to the will of God. By the time of the Prophet's death in 632, Islam had spread to almost every part of Arabia. You have to realize that Arabia at the time was a bunch of tribes with little petty tribal gods all fighting each other. So this was really a miracle. The Prophet's closest friends and family members invented a new political institution, the Caliphate. The Caliph succeeded to Muhammad's leadership, but without a mandate to deviate from the Prophet's words. That is, he was a political executor, you might say, but he couldn't talk about religion. The revelations of the Prophet were collected and standardized in book form, the Quran, to preserve them from corruption. By 711, Muslims had conquered from Spain in the west to Pakistan in the east. There had also been a change in the caliphate. A civil war over the succession to the assassinated third caliph ended in 661 with the Umayyad dynasty based in Syria. The supporters of the Prophet's first cousin and son-in-law, Ali ibn Abi Talib, and his descendants developed a religious rationale for their allegiance and formed the Shi'at Ali, or the Party of Ali, known as the Shi'at sect of Islam. In 750, the Umayyads were defeated by the Abbasids from eastern Iran and moved their government to Baghdad. 200 years later, the Shi'at Buyid tribesmen conquered them. 100 years later, the Seljuk Turks came out of the east and took power. They were Sunnis. In 1258, Genghis Khan's Mongols sacked Baghdad and went on to Vienna and put the last Abbasid caliph to death. After that, the Ottoman Empire took over Turkey, the Balkans, and after 1516, most of the lands of the Arabs and the Shiites of Safavid Empire in Iran. Then came Napoleon's invasion of Egypt in 1798. And then World War I, and the Turkish Empire was dissolved. So my author concludes with, only with the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979 does the struggle of Muslim activists seeking to recenter society and politics around Islamic values reemerge. So during that whole period of time, they were all split up in small groups. This bully, it claims, is the view from the center that historians always use to describe Islam, but it leaves too many questions unanswered. Where did all those Muslims come from? Why did they develop a coherent civilization while Europe was so fractious and diverse? What is the role of religion in their society? Whom do the people follow? Who responds to their needs? Most Muslims outside the Arab Peninsula are not Arabs. They learned about Muhammad from the oral teachings of Muhammad's companions, and when they died, from their followers. The Ulama, a remarkable body of religious scholars and moral guides living in every community, traveling to study under famous teachers. They studied and wrote on law, theology, Quran interpretation, the traditions of the Prophet. Others devoted time and energy to compiling biographical dictionaries of hundreds of thousands of ulama with various data relating to them. And this author has spent 25 years reading those descriptions, so in effort to find out what was really going on there. In 1146, a religious scholar from northeastern Iran, Abdelkhamen al-Samani, completed the book on proper conduct in teaching and studying hadith. A hadith consisted of a statement made or an act performed by the Prophet Muhammad, which was remembered by his followers or his companions, and then orally told to people from then on. And every time you told this hadith, you had to say where you heard it. So it goes like, I heard from A, who said he heard from B, who said he heard from the messenger of God, God's prayers and peace be upon him. And this is called an isnad, the list of names, which listed each person who had heard with his own ears the person before him, clear back to the words ascribed to the prophet. Almost everything Muslims knew about the prophet's life and behavior was preserved in the form of a hadith. And no hadith is considered authoritative without its accompanying isnad. You have to tell who said it, and then it has to be somebody who really heard it. You can't read it in a book. The isnad is the believer's weapon. This system is an oral tradition, not a memory tradition. Boys who knew Arabic began attending hadith sessions between the age of 5 and 10 and continued until their 20s, then went to work, and when they were 50 became teachers. Religious authority came from the oral transmissions of sacred lore. People who only heard books were not considered authorities. 250 years after Muhammad's death, hadiths were divided into weak and sound. And by the 13th century, six books of sound traditions were accepted as canons for the Sunni majority. This resulted in a homogeneous body of Islam texts that developed giving a growing uniformity of Islamic belief, which was taught in the madrasas, which are the schools for the ulamas or students, all over throughout and continuously throughout the conquest. So even though there were wars and fighting going on, the madrasas were established and people were learning about all of the famous sayings of Muhammad at the same time. And there were schools in Spain and schools in India, and the whole extent of the Muslim conquest and had schools and teachers, and that's the other complaint. Of course, it's totally patriarchal. There are a few women who recited hadith, but there were so few that he doesn't use a female pronoun. He said, he gave a couple of examples. Well, after conquering the country, the Muslim government gave people a choice of accepting Islam, retaining their Christian or Jewish allegiance and paying taxes, or being destroyed. So they might have been given to Arab soldiers as slaves and learned about Islam by living with the Muslims and converting and then being free. That was another alternative. Or they may have lived in Arab communities and seen that there were benefits from trading with Muslims. Or they might have met an Arab who spoke their language and learned of Islam that way. There's an interesting novel about Suleiman, who was the Turkish emperor in about 1500, and he married a Circassian slave from the north who was a red-haired Russian-looking girl, and she was converted from Christianity to being a Muslim. Islam is more able to eventually adapt to their way of life in a modern Western-dominated society and maintain their religion, asking diverse religious questions and having a great potential for independent action. The Catholic Church is bound by the bureaucracy. You can't do anything the Pope doesn't like. But there's no person like that in the Muslim organization. Well, we know that there's a teacher, you know, Harry Run, who is right now telling people what to do, but he's only there for as long as he's there. He's not, if he dies, somebody else is going to be accepted. They have to be accepted by their people in order to be a person. They have to be consulted by the people in order to be a powerful person. He says, parallel moments of change have occurred before in the 8th and 10th centuries, and the 12th and 14th centuries in Islam. And Islam has responded to the needs of very different humans, accommodating to local customs. So something that happens in Afghanistan might shock the people in Damascus, you know, because they're totally different, but they're still both Muslim. In establishing stability, community, and morality of a half-remembered past is what could happen. But he says the final shape of modern Islam is too distant to discern. So if, you know, I've been going around saying, what can you do about all those people? You just have to wait, and history will take care of them. I think that's all I prepared. I've got a great long list of books here. I brought some on the back that have pictures of Islam and things like that. And I think probably one of my favorite books is the Book of Jay, because he says Jay was probably a woman in the court after King Solomon. And the thing that's interesting about these various aspects of the Bible, you know, the Yahweh and the J and the P and so forth, is that the way they can tell is from the way the language is used. That the structure and rules of writing were different at different periods. And the way he talked about somebody was different at different periods. So they can tell where one writer starts and where he leaves off, where another writer starts. Another interesting thing we ran into in Egypt, there's a Hebrew temple on the back street, and beside the temple is this sort of boxy looking sandstone building. And it has in it all of the writings of the Jews from the time they came to Egypt, because they never throw away a piece of paper that God's name on it. And the Muslims did the same thing. He describes a spot where he came to this small building where it was 5 feet deep in manuscripts from the Muslim rewriting and revision. So it's a fascinating thing to be involved in. Any questions? Well, one of the things that he mentions is that the two parts, the religious part, were the common people, the teachers who lived in the communities all over in every country, would interpret and tell people the religion, but the laws were separate, and the kings and emperors and sultans protected the Sharia, the law-giving branch, and the Sharia protected the king. So they really worked together, but not like where we try to have separation of church and state. One of the problems that's happening in Iran now is when they started importing European teachings, and all their students went to Europe to study, and then people came from Europe to Egypt and Iran and Iraq to teach, and they established state schools. All the schools in Muslim countries are run by the state and paid for by the state. People don't have to pay for them. And of course, then the schools have to teach what the state wants. They can't teach heresies. But they are teaching European ideas. So there's developed a whole group of young people who don't know much about Islam, you know, are just just always to European ideas of success and fine clothes and whatever, having a drink before dinner and stuff, that kind of thing. And then there's the people in the countryside who are still going by the old rules. So there's a big sort of conflict there. And when the young people are looking for a leader and for inspiration and trying to go back to their Islamic roots, it's a problem because they don't think the same anymore. But he says it'll iron out in the end. Well, but as I understand it, some of the decisions can be appealed. I'm not saying everything's cool there. I mean, it's obviously there's the brownie points they get from fighting for their religion and what's it called again? The jihad. Yeah, the jihad. According to this guy, they get their authority from people following them. So if they don't have any students and they don't have any followers, they aren't successful. So they have to be accepted in their community and looked up to and in order to be a teacher. So it's not like an election, but they're chosen because people agree with them. Then when this mullah dies, they go and ask somebody, who else should I go to? So the Ayatollah Khomeini is one of them. Solomon is a common name that Islam religion uses. They have three or four, Moses and Joseph and Abraham and Solomon are names that they name their kids. And Solomon is one of those. But he was the king of Turkey in about 1500, around there in the 60s. They had another interesting thing too. They had slave soldiers. They would go out and fight, and they'd bring back these young men, and they'd take them to the palace school, and they'd teach them, they'd educate them to read and understand and to accept, and then they were the core of the most effective army. And some of those soldiers became generals and advisors to the king, and also caliphs too.
Thank you very much. Stimulates people's interest.
I forgot something.
You forgot something.
I forgot to ask you guys to tell me what famous books you think have made a big difference. And there's a little paperback that I found in my junk, and it says, famous books that have made a difference. And I put the list on the back table. So there's about 40, I think, in that list. But if you have some book, like somebody told me Euclid was a famous book.
Euclid Fellows, that was my Euclid.
Was that you?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know anything about that. So, if Euclid was a famous book, somebody else has to talk about it.
It's a man.
Okay.
It's a mathematician.